want the Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. Today we're going to talk about the police. No, not Der Stingel and the boys, but the police in the United States of America. And will illegal violence by police officers be reduced or eliminated by issuing body cameras to every cop on the beat in the U.S. of A.? Shahid Buttar joins us in just a moment. He's executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, and he's going to raise some important questions about whether body cams are not really just a distraction from the more important issues, and the fact that you can shoot video, but if the cops control access to it, that may not move things along. We've also seen that in the case of Eric Garner, where there's a video, and Tamir Rice, where there's a video, that the outcomes didn't really fall along the lines of real justice. That's what's coming up today. Before we get to our conversation with Shahid Buttar, I want to thank the people who support my work with your subscriptions to the PBC podcast. Folks like Bob Donjacor, Bill Goodacre, Andy Krieger, and Robert Littweiler, who just renewed his annual subscription. I'd like you to join them. Come on over to peterbcollins.com, follow the sign-up link under my picture on the homepage, and choose the best deal for you, $5, $10, $20 a month, or the $50 annual subscription. And new annual subscribers anywhere within the sound of my voice get a bonus gift. It's an e-book edition of Pepe Escobar's new collection of columns called Empire of Chaos. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.
Swinging in the backyard, pull up in your fast car, whistling my name. Open up a beer, and you say get over here and play a video game.
Lana Del Rey opens our podcast, our in-depth interview today. The song is called Video Games. And one of the proposals circulating in the land today is to equip every police officer with a body cam. This in response to the protests that arose in Ferguson, Missouri, in Staten Island, New York, and elsewhere about bad deeds by police officers on duty. And let's not exclude Cleveland, where Tamir Rice was gunned down, and there is a video of that incident. Shahid Buttar is the executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, and their website is at bordc.org. As always, Shahid, great to talk with you. Thanks for joining me today.
Great to talk with you, Peter. Thanks so much for bringing me on.
Now, you've written a piece that people can find at your website. I also read it over at truthout.org, where you're raising some very important questions about whether the proposed solution to the myriad problems that we're encountering in our criminal justice system, especially as the system is applied to people of color, that the solution is to equip officers with body cameras. And you're not so sure about that. In fact, you raise some important arguments, at least against believing that this is the ultimate solution. And you also state some of the unintended consequences of this effort that's been embraced by President Obama. Let's start with the big picture, Shahid. Do you see this as just another form of invasive surveillance?
I'd see it as a little bit more than that, but I guess to start at the widest picture, I would say that this is a threat to the movement for police accountability and a proposed reform that would ultimately set our movement back and undermine its aims. And I think the key, the reason why I see it is even more than an extension of surveillance, is that this could be the bulwark for another, a whole other wave of mass incarceration. You know, if we think we have a problem with mass incarceration now, it could get much, much worse when every police officer has a body camera that is ambiently monitoring everything within their field of vision all the time, without any individualized suspicion required, without, you know, any constitutional limit. Like, this is going to justify, quite likely, an expansion of police abuses, and I don't think that the people clamoring for it are necessarily seeing it through that lens.
That's a very important point, and honestly, I had not given that much thought before I read your piece, because I've been focused on the misdeeds by police officers on duty and the need for the public to have evidence of this to overcome the collusion that is often obvious between law enforcement and the prosecutors who bring cases against individuals. But this could create even more Big Brother tentacles out in the community. And when we look at the capability of the government to analyze videos, to use facial recognition software to see who is with you in the car, for example,
That's right.
The intrusive and expansive nature of this starts to become more clear.
Absolutely. When you think about all of the tools, for instance, that the government uses with aerial surveillance drones, which are very sophisticated, you know, way beyond reading a license plate from, you know, 10,000 feet. You know, we're talking about, like, and I don't know if they can do retinal scans from that kind of distance, but certainly facial recognition or gait recognition, you know, to recognize how people walk. There are all these very advanced tools that can be used to track people. And those same tools could be used in, you know, by an officer with a body camera, for instance, to identify someone selling loose cigarettes across the street. You know, and that's exactly what Eric Garner was killed for, without trial or any opportunity to contest the charges against him in New York City by two police officers who were exonerated, not even exonerated. They never had to be exonerated. They never faced prosecution for killing an unarmed, unthreatening, disarmingly polite person to his last breath on video that was accessible to the public. And that's one of the keys to the body camera debate. Video of an incident does nothing. We had that when Eric Garner died. We had that when Tamir Rice died. Just because, for instance, we don't know and can't prove the precise circumstances of, for instance, Michael Brown's death, doesn't mean that having a video recording of it would change anything, particularly because, and this is the kicker, without the law changing to make police accountable for their crimes, whether they happen on camera or whether they happen off camera, unless the laws change to force police accountability, the cameras don't do anything. It's a red herring at best, which is to say it distracts from at least two issues. Body cameras seem to promise transparency into individual discrete incidents, like, for instance, the untimely death of Michael Brown. At best, that's what they give. But here's the holes in the bucket. The first is that the cops don't often give away or give the public access to footage of police cameras. It's not as if body cameras would be the first time police ever used video. They capture video, for instance, all the time mm-hmm. at political demonstrations. But if you need to prove a civil claim that a police officer injured someone, for instance, while they were being arrested, you can't get that video, right? The police departments have not ever been in the business of sharing with the public what they capture by way of video evidence. So there's no reason to think first that a police body camera even equals transparency even into the discrete incident. Even if it did, though, there's two other problems, and these are much bigger than that. The first is transparency into patterns and practices. That's where the action's at. That's where you see the rage around the country and the concern boiling over. It's because these are not isolated incidents. For every Mike Brown and every Tamir Rice and every Eric Garner, there's 1,000 kids thrown against a wall, terrified of becoming the next one, just on their way home from school. right? And then, so these are patterns and practices, and body cameras don't do anything for transparency into those. And even if they did, which they don't provide accountability. Body cameras are an easy way for the political establishment to get off the hook, and an easy way to throw, if the president's proposal goes through, $250 million to inflate police budgets even further than they already have been, in essentially rewarding crimes. And I think that that money could be much better spent on violence prevention, youth counseling, job training, any of the programs that under-resourced communities have been clamoring for decades.
Now, I agree with that, but what I would propose is that local law enforcement agencies take the gear that they've gotten from the Pentagon under the 1033 program and put it up for sale on eBay.
There you go. Yeah, that'll fetch them some money. The only problem is who's gonna buy it, right? Then you've got Russian oligarchs running around with tanks and whatever. But yes, you're onto something there.
Now, I think it's
not unlike the asset forfeiture debate. You're onto something. You know, a lot of people in Congress are taking, in fact, the incoming chair of one of the oversight committees, whose name escapes me, you know, this is all in very much real time, but the new Republican leadership is interested in addressing asset forfeiture laws, which have been essentially a corrupt tool for police departments to mm-hmm. get their hands on all kinds of fancy toys. So, you know, at least some other people are thinking in the same direction.
Now, let me challenge a couple of your points here, Shahid, because I really don't disagree with the issues that you've raised. But I believe that the kinds of systemic reforms that you're calling for and that could be, pushed aside if the idea of body cams is, you know, foisted on us as the beginning and end of reforms. But I believe that the power of these videos on an anecdotal basis really helps drive public sentiment and the protests that have developed in communities that weren't even directly affected by these three calamities over the past few months. And so, because of the way our media works, because of the way people use the internet and put videos up on Facebook, for example, these individual cases take on greater importance and have more sway, in my opinion, because the public can clearly see the disparity between the video evidence and the really weak or cover-up reactions of a prosecutor or a grand jury. And right. So, you know, I do believe that over time, if we have more video of cops who are breaking the law while they're on duty, that there will be more pressure building on a broad consensus basis for the true reforms that we need.
Point well taken, but I just give it to you like this. You know, the videos that got people in the streets were not police body camera footage. They were citizen iPhone captured in New York. In Cleveland, it was official surveillance footage, I think by a camera nearby, but not a body cam. I'm trying to think of the other incidents caught on videotape. There's no shortage of videotape. Mm-hmm. The video of police beating people up, that's not new. And I dare say, as much as I would like for it to be, whether it's there or not, it's not news. It's just because there's going to suddenly be thousands of police body cam images of people getting beaten up or in some respects killed. We've already had that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why people are activating. And so, again, I think you're right in that maybe the next, having the body cam footage of the next, you know, unarmed innocent person being gunned down in the street, maybe that will make a difference. It hasn't made a difference yet. And we have had it. I mean, just mm-hmm. to be clear.
Yeah.
You're absolutely
right about that. What I'm talking about is that over time, the other aspect of this is that if a cop knows that he'll be disciplined if his camera is not running when he makes a stop or an arrest that turns into some sort of a controversy, that will check their behavior in ways that I wouldn't want imposed on me. There's a personal constitutional intrusion there, but I think that on balance, it's more important to put these cops on notice that they can't act with impunity and make up facts after an incident because there is video that will contradict the fiction that they write.
We're absolutely on the same page as everything you're saying, except for the mechanism through which to achieve it. And I would just say, for instance, you know, going back to the utility of citizen video, which is much more reliable than police video, it's more accessible than police video, and it's also a lot cheaper than police video. If we are really concerned with putting cops on notice and we're really concerned about making sure there's a steady drip of stories to focus the public on what's happening under our noses, the best way to do that would be simply to prohibit police departments from arresting people for videotaping their activities.
Well, didn't Illinois just pass a law that explicitly makes it a crime to videotape a policeman on duty?
It's going exactly the wrong way. And so that's my point, is that police body cameras are a very, very poor substitute for the far better alternatives of, if we want meaningful change, it's accountability. If we want meaningful transparency, it's transparency to patterns and practices. And even if we want to settle for transparency into individual incidents, if that's the best we think we can get as a movement, we should at least in that case make sure we get it, and that we get it out of the hands of the police. And the only way to do that is to make sure that videotaping the police is not an offense. And as soon as that happens, we suddenly have 300 million Americans with cameras in our pockets, all of whom will keep the police on notice. And that's a far more robust transparency measure, a far more robust opportunity to get the images in front of media sources and in front of the public, and a far more robust way to ensure that the wheels of justice turn than by giving the agencies that we've already seen commit wanton abuses, that we've already seen cover up their tracks in the face even of demonstrated clear public record of criminal activity, rather than giving those agencies yet more money to have new tools to use against us. And I do think, you know, going back to where we started the discussion, proponents of body cameras are not grappling with its implications for mass incarceration, and that is far, far more disturbing, I think. It's dystopian if you think about it, because in some ways what's happening now is people are reacting to some horrific abuses, you know, murders with impunity. And if what we get as basically a trade for our political activation is a tool for further incarceration of our communities, and it would be not just ironic and tragic, it would be horrific. I think it would be all those things. Mm-hmm. But that's the scenario I see playing out under our feet.
And Shahid, I'll underscore a point you made earlier in the context of your most recent remark about the value of having, you know, hundreds or thousands of people with their own phone cameras capturing footage. The custody of that footage is much more open source, as you pointed out earlier, than that is held by the police and essentially under the control of the police and the district attorney. And that is a very substantive issue. But I think it speaks to the need to drive this reform in the right direction, and that's what you're attempting to do. Let me raise one other point. Vice News reported just a day or so ago that the LA Police Department has announced that they're going to issue tasers to officers, but those tasers will trigger video recording and track information on the use of the taser in much greater detail than is the case today. And in some ways, I consider this to be an improvement, because I'm very leery of tasers. I certainly, approve of tasers as a less deadly form of assault by a police officer. But there are many other issues related to tasers. They're more dangerous than the manufacturers make out. And also the training of officers, as we saw in the BART situation here a few years ago, is very weak and problematic in its own way.
Yeah, in fact, there was a front cover story in the Miami Herald, I believe it is, the paper of record there, this week, about tasers being essentially overused by the local police. And I think the move to trigger a video when a taser is used, I mean, that's only a good thing. I'm glad that the LAPD is doing that. I've never thought that I would ever use the words "I'm glad" and LAPD in the same sentence before. But I'm glad that they've taken that step. That's clearly a step in the right direction. But you know, tasers, like body cameras, are really not the solution to a problem. They are lethal weapons. And in fact, the manufacturers have been forced to concede that they are merely less lethal weapons. But people die from taser attacks all the time, even when the cops grab the right instrument. Unlike, you know, when Oscar Grant died and the cops claims to have, you know, reached for his taser and grabbed the other, you know, the gun instead. Even when someone uses the taser, tasers kill. And in Miami, what this independent investigation uncovered was the cops were widely using tasers as a form of extrajudicial punishment, you know, not in an effort to subdue anyone, mm-hmm. not to disarm a threatening person, you know, but just as a tool to be used willy-nilly on the street. And that's, of course, it's the same problem with drone strikes by the CIA. When you reduce the perceived cost of using force, right, boots on the ground expose U.S. troops to death, drones in the sky do not, so we'll use drones in the sky because it's easier, just like, you know, taser's going to have less of a risk of killing someone. But when you reduce the cost of using force, it invites the force to be used more. And that's one of the problems that tasers present, is at least in Miami, they've encouraged essentially the police terrorizing entire communities there using these new sophisticated weapons that, again, you know, to chase the money, are made by a corporate contractor that's making a buck off of all this.
Mm-hmm. Shahid, I want to commend you for your critical thinking and your advocacy here, because I think you've raised important issues that those who are protesting the current sorry state of law enforcement, the use of deadly force and incarceration are rightfully rising up against. But for me, these are symptoms of a much bigger problem. And the bigger problem is really brought into sharp relief by the behavior of the New York Police Department since the killing of the two officers right before Christmas. And their attacks on Mayor de Blasio, the rude behavior of turning their backs on him at public funerals while they're in uniform, while I grant their First Amendment right to express themselves even in those circumstances, that doesn't mean that it's wise to do so. And when you link their arrogant behavior with the messaging that comes from, is it Patrick Hearn, the police benevolent, the union leader? Who said that de Blasio had blood on his hands, and Giuliani, who says that Obama has led the call to hate the police. This really shows that police believe they're above the law. And I won't make that as a sweeping indictment, but too many police officers do. And this institutional arrogance, which is compounded now by their refusal to do their jobs. They've got a kind of version of blue flu where they show up for work, but they're not writing parking tickets or issuing citations or arrest warrants in a remarkable drop in law enforcement. And this risky, arrogant behavior, I think, shows, it really exposes the true problem we have. And that is that the police can't be trusted. And they think that the solution to this is authoritarianism and not some sort of a relaunch or a reorganization of the relationship between police and the communities they are supposed to serve.
Speak it, brother. Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's been appalling to me to witness what I would just describe briefly as the shameful unprofessionalism of the NYPD. And it's amazing to me that those guys draw public paychecks. I mean, yes, right. Everybody's got a First Amendment right. It is different when you use your job as a platform and your job is funded by taxpayers whom your agencies have made histories of abusing. And you know, the audacity here to walk off the job in response to basically criticism, because that's all de Blasio's done, right? He's never thrown in his lot with the hate the police types. And in fact, you know, in appointing Bill Bratton as the NYPD's commissioner, the commissioner of the New York Police Department, Bill Bratton is, you know, he came out of the NYPD. De Blasio made a lot of hay on the campaign trail about NYPD abuses, while from the standpoint of communities in New York, when he got into the mayor's office, just like Obama, he's done everything he could to appease the law enforcement and intelligence agencies. You know, they've bent over backward to accommodate law enforcement. You know, Obama's re-signed the Patriot Act several times. He's closer to the drone strike program than a U.S. president ever has been to a covert program. There's, you know, he's actively involved in it as essentially a participant in the decisions of who lives and dies at that granular a level, right? I mean, the law enforcement agencies have co-opted these nominally progressive electeds, and so the idea that they're being hung out to dry is somehow insufficiently supportive of the police unions is ridiculous. And let's be, you know, remember, you don't have to work as a cop, right? If it's too hot in that kitchen, hang up the badge and get another job. I'm not going to use the line that I've heard people say to me when I'm exercising my First Amendment rights. But it is striking to me that cops are willing to draw a public paycheck while refusing to abide by the community sentiments and being so arrogant as to walk off the job just in the face of criticism. And I certainly would never condone violence against anyone. And the people who have murdered police should face justice, just like the police who murder unarmed people should face justice. But it's ridiculous to think that the deaths of two officers and assaults on other officers justify the NYPD walking off the job, especially when de Blasio has done everything he could to support them. And the last thing I'd say here is that what it might ultimately expose, if there is any measure of irony and justice, what it will expose is how little the new city of New York needs hypervigilant policing. Because, you know, the NYPD's walked off the job, but the city hasn't fallen into chaos. You know, we don't need to be policed this way. What I think the NYPD is proving in walking off the job is that we could shrink most of our police departments by 50% to 75% and still live in perfectly secure, safe communities.
It is a risky work slowdown. And Shahid, you know, I staunchly defend First Amendment rights, even of, I'm blocking on the name of the church from Topeka, Kansas, that won the Supreme Court decision about protesting at funerals.
I forget their name, too. But yes, I know who you're talking about.
You know which one I mean. And also, you know, for months now, we have had a longshore workers slowdown on the West Coast at Los Angeles and Oakland. They're in contract negotiations, and they're making a point. By working more slowly, there's a backlog of ships with containers that want to be unloaded. And I think that is a legitimate tactic for longshore workers. I think it's different for public employees in law enforcement. I don't think that they have the right to selectively slow down their work to make a political point. And I'd love to see this aired out in court, because I think that there are limits on a sworn peace officer's right to, you know, conduct a job action of this nature.
That's tricky. I mean, I am certainly a pro-labor person, and so on the one hand, I'm loath to accept restrictions on the right to organize in itself. Certainly, police unions and to an equal degree, firefighters unions often find themselves in a different position politically vis-a-vis the rest of the labor movement, just on account of, you know, who those professions draw from, and, you know, the fact that they essentially work for the state. They're public sector employees, but in a very different context, for instance, than, say, teachers. So there's different political interests. But to draw different legal rights because of the differently situated industries, you know, I could see, for instance, that argument being extended certainly to transit workers, who could be perceived as no less necessary, food workers. You know, there's plenty of industries. You think about the airline controllers in Reagan. You know, anyone deemed necessary could be approached in that same fashion. And so I'm really hesitant to embrace a legal restriction on the right of the police to slow down. I just think politically it really reveals the NYPD to be, among other things, insubordinate, arrogant, I think you used the word. Others, though, I mean, shameful is one of them, but what I really think it reflects is petulance.
Yes.
And that's a really unattractive thing in the world's seventh largest army. You know, like the NYPD can get over it, quite frankly. You know, like the rest of New York has had to bear much more than the department has.
But in the big picture, we see people like Giuliani riding this wave, and it has taken the wind out of the sails of protesters in the aftermath of the Eric Garner case. And it has shifted the focus from the rights of the public to an attempt to elicit what I consider to be misplaced sympathy for the police in an effort to just, grind out the protests and ignore the clear wrongdoing, even if it wasn't prosecuted, that triggered the protests.
I think you're right about all that. Two additional points, I think, though, is that one, I think most people see the slowdown as a joke at best. You know, it certainly, I don't think, is buying the department any new allies. That would seem hard to suggest. You know, at best, there are some middle-class people who feel coerced into accepting its demands. But let's just be frank. I mean, I don't think they're the ones on the front line of the struggle anyway, right? So I don't think the struggle's going anywhere. At best, this is a momentary distraction. But again, I think it's one that ultimately undermines police departments institutionally and promotes the movement because it's exposing a pettiness that, again, you know, if anyone has a right here to feel aggrieved, it is not the departments who've gotten away with murdering innocent people for decades and making money off of it, right, and mm-hmm. getting their pensions off of it. And it's just, I think it's a clear overstep for the department. And I think at the end of the day, what I really fear, going back to the body camera piece, is that the movement's continuing mobilization plays into the establishment's hands by being answered with a reform that ultimately rewards those departments for their intransigence and for, you know, the kind of petulance that we're talking about now. You know, if the answer to Eric Garner dying is a bunch of people taking action, then the NYPD slowing down and walking off the job and then getting rewarded with new toys to put more people in jail, that's not the outcome that I certainly hope for. Yeah. But that's exactly what we're hurtling towards as we speak.
And Shahid, my memory kicked in. It was the Westboro Baptist Church and the monster named Fred Phelps, who I interviewed a few times before he died a couple of years ago. But now allow me to zoom out even further to the big picture of the work that you do at BORDC, the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. Because the last year, we had some modest hopes for some mild reforms in mass surveillance, nothing happened. It was killed, even though they watered that bill down and made sure that it wouldn't do much. It nonetheless didn't survive the process, even when the Democrats controlled the Senate. And there's no prospect for those types of reforms to occur over the next 2 years with the expanded control that Republicans have. And likewise, Senator Feinstein, who has a very weak record on protecting our constitutional rights, particularly when it comes to the surveillance issues, nonetheless showed some courage in pushing to have her carefully limited, heavily redacted executive summary of the torture report released. But the way it was spun up, because it was framed around whether it had worked or not, as opposed to whether it was moral or not, we see polls now where 2/3 of the American public think that torture can be justified and that it actually produces intelligence, even though that was the central point of Feinstein's entire effort. And so what we see is, despite the protests on various fronts, despite the efforts of activists and reformers to try to return us to constitutional rule and to curb the growth of the police state, we lost big time in 2014, and we have no momentum going forward. And we have a White House that speaks to our concerns as it enables the opponents of reform every step of the way.
Well said on almost all fronts. I'm with you with 90% of it. So, and I will just reiterate the points where we agree. 2014 was a horrible year for civil liberties. Despite the Snowden revelations in 2013, Congress has done not a damn thing to change the landscape since. And in CIA torture and the investigation into it, and there was much ado about the revelation of relatively little in the report, but it has triggered a debate. And where I want to focus then are the prospects for reform going forward, both on torture and NSA spying, because I guess where I would dissent from you is that I do see greater opportunities going forward, particularly because Republicans now run Congress.
All right.
So there is a wing of the Republican Party, not the majority of it, but in the House, that has been very, very critical of mass surveillance, far more critical than Democrats ever have been. And so point one here is that Democrats are the reason that mass surveillance persists, at least the president and certainly a very large block of the Democratic senators and members of Congress have voted time and again to reauthorize the Patriot Act and to repudiate or resist efforts to limit it. that we're at every point in the chain bipartisan. At no point has this ever been a partisan struggle. Republicans and Democrats alike, in growing numbers over the last 10 years, have come to embrace the constitutional perspective and remember that we're supposed to be a country of laws, not arbitrary powers wielded by agencies created to keep us safe. The prospects for reform going forward are greater for a couple of reasons. The first is that the Patriot Act is set to expire this year. Well, not all of it, but three sections of it are set to expire this spring in 2015. And if Congress does nothing, those provisions will expire. One of the provisions at issue is the one that would have been reformed by the statute you referred to, the bill that you referred to last session, the USA Freedom Act.
Mm-hmm.
It's Section 215 of the Patriot Act, enabling the government to, some people call it the library records provision. You can use it to demand any tangible thing related to a terrorism investigation.
Right.
The government's been secretly construing it for years to enable mass telephone surveillance. It's one of, and this is a key point here, it's one of several different sources, the legal authorities, claimed by the NSA to support the phone and the internet dragnet, particularly the phone dragnet in the case of Section 215.
Right.
The USA Freedom Act failed to curtail it, but if Congress does nothing again, as it did last year, it will die entirely. And I don't know if the pro-NSA, pro-FBI, pro-dragnet forces can muster a majority in this Congress with the populist Republican minority having the role that it does in the House, basically. And I don't think Democrats are going to have a lot of cover here because Republicans will be leading the fight, partly because Obama's in the White House and they're going to want to make him look bad, and partly, quite frankly, because they have there's a certain legislative nihilism.
Mm-hmm.
I can't,
yeah.
Like the best word I've heard sort of to describe it. And that also plays in the direction of stasis here, procedural stasis, mm-hmm. which, again, reverses the law. On CIA torture, I think there's a lot of momentum as well, particularly because we were just talking about the movement for police accountability emerging from Ferguson and elsewhere. It's challenging the same things. In both contexts, we're talking about arbitrary state violence with impunity. And whether it's murder of a detainee on the, from hypothermia of sitting naked in a cold concrete cell in sub-zero temperature held by the CIA, or whether it's the murder of a criminal suspect by New York Police Department officers using an illegal chokehold. Either way, you're talking about murder with impunity by people employed by the state to keep us safe. And I think there's a huge intersection among those issues. And if the movement for police accountability can avoid being co-opted by body cameras, if we can focus our attention on the kinds of solutions embraced by groups on the ground in Ferguson and elsewhere, like, for instance, the End Racial Profiling Act,
mm-hmm.
which is part of the platform of the Organization for Black Struggle and the Hands Up Coalition in Ferguson. It's been embraced by the folks on the ground in New York City. these are available solutions, and we should clamor for them and extend that critique beyond the agencies most visible to us to the ones that are essentially invisible to us but committing the same offenses, whether mm-hmm. it's CIA drone strikes of innocent people abroad or, murdering and torturing detainees. And if you think about the issues you and I have talked about before, the statutory powers under the Defense Authorization Act enabling
right.
the Pentagon to detain Americans, if torture is allowed to become institutionalized, it will be one of the black holes through which American democracy sinks, because it's a classic and well-established way across lots of contexts, centuries old now, to destroy one's political opposition. And, our current political leadership might not be mature enough not to use that lever in that kind of dastardly way.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole reason we used to be a nation of laws instead of executive agencies was to keep that kind of thing from happening.
Right.
And there are not. Once you embrace torture, all the controls come off, because anyone who's suspected then instantly becomes guilty. And that's the danger of embracing torture. That's why it will poison any justice system that embraces it. And that's exactly why we have to make sure that everyone involved in the CIA or the Defense Department's torture programs, including the lawyers in the Department of Justice, that all of them face prosecution for their crimes.
Well, and we should start by sacking John Brennan and Alfreda Frances Bukowski, who continues to work at the CIA despite the clear record of her abuses and transgressions. President Obama will not do that. He's under no real political pressure to do so. And Shahid, I take your point that, I'm glad to see that you see some opportunities with the new Republican, the expanded control of the House and the new control of the Senate. And I do agree with you that Justin Amash and a handful of other Republicans in the House have been much more pro-Constitution when it comes to the surveillance programs. The problem we have is that we saw with the so-called Cromnibus bill that when Boehner can't rally a majority of his members, that the Democrats come to his rescue. And unfortunately, I fear that Pelosi, who has been really, really weak on these issues, will provide enough votes to keep, for example, the Patriot Act in effect when it expires coming up this year.
I think the real issue comes down to the Democratic base and whether or not they hold their elected leaders accountable to the principles that they espouse. You know, because Democrats lost the mantle of civil liberties over the last 8 years to the Republican Party. Unfortunately, you know, Democrats did a great job of speaking a big game under the Bush administration, abandoned those principles when in office. And I do think that it's up to the Democratic base to make very clear that this is a priority.
Well,
that we are not willing.
Just on that note, Shahid, in my news and comment podcast on Thursday, January 8th, I mentioned that Senator Boxer of California has finally announced that she won't seek reelection in 2016. And when George Bush was in the White House, she was a fierce fighter against the wars and, you know, against the surveillance programs. And when Obama became president, even though in 2008 she and Russ Feingold led the effort to prevent the extension of the FISA law that Obama had promised to vote against, and then once he secured the nomination, he flipped and voted for it, she has lost that appetite for any kind of a fight. And I believe that in California, we need to make sure that her replacement is someone who will reflect the values of the base when it comes to issues of war, surveillance, and detention and torture.
I could not agree more. I think you're absolutely right about that. I think Senator Boxer has done great service to the nation over the years, even though I think you're right, she lost her stomach for some of those efforts in the more recent past. But it would be great if the great state of California could be represented by someone finally worthy of its population. And, you know, that hasn't happened in a long time.
You're right.
But I really do hope to see someone reflective of the state's political independence. And this is a piece worth driving home, too. It doesn't matter if you're Bay Area or Southern California. It doesn't matter if you're left or right. If you're in California, there is a certain independence of mind that has always defined that state. And even if you're relatively conservative along the California spectrum, let's say you're in San Diego, you know, if you're in San Diego and, you know, you're working, let's say maybe in a military related industry, just realize the way that the military bears the costs of these things. You know, torture places military service members at risk in the same way that surveillance kills the freedom of the society it supposedly protects. And I think that people in the West, I hope, would have the independence of mind to treat skeptically these very self-serving claims from Washington that attempt to justify the entrenchment of these powers. And whether it's CIA torture, NSA spying, local police profiling or brutality, any of those agencies covering up their tracks and lying to legislators and Congress, as all of them have done repeatedly, these are crimes against all of us. And they're crimes of the worst kind because they're crimes that we pay for, not only in being harmed by the crimes, but by literally paying the salaries of the people who are abusing us. And only we, the people, can bring it to an end. And I hope very much that we, through our elected leaders, are able to finally do that in 2015.
Well, Shahid, I really appreciate your strong advocacy, your leadership on these issues. You make a good argument, you give a good argument, and I always enjoy talking with you. But before we wrap up, you had indicated to me before we started our conversation today that unfortunately you've had to make some cutbacks at the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. And I want to encourage my listeners to visit your website, bordc.org. And some of my listeners have money. Not every one of them, but some of them do. And if you're one of those people with some extra bucks in the bank, I can't think of a more worthy effort than what Shahid and his team do every day at the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. Can I donate right on the website there, Shahid?
You can, absolutely. At www.bordc.org.
Yep, there's a big orange donate button right in the upper right corner. I see it there.
Thank you for the plug. That means a lot to me. And as long as you're sharing it, I will just say there are not a lot of groups in the country doing transpartisan grassroots organizing to curtail executive agencies run amok. And that's exactly what we're doing at the state, local, and federal level with a skeleton crew increasingly stretched across the country. And we could do a lot more with a little bit of help.
All right.
Please get in touch with us.
Okay. Shahid Buttar, thank you, sir. We'll talk again soon.
Thank you so much, Peter. Keep up the great work. Have a great day.
I'd like to hear your feedback. Drop me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com. And thanks for listening.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.